that. Excuse me a second. This is tape two of the conversation. Mr. Powell, proceed.
On that business, Governor Myrdal, Governor Myrdal, right. Governor Myrdal,
yes.
proposed a take on the relocation. Now, that's the one that people get so emotionally upset about also. And yet, one of the main features of the Manpower Developer Training Act, which was my first major bill, New York Times said it might go down in history as the greatest labor bill of this century. And then my vocational education bill, we put in those bills federal funds to relocate people Come on in. They take the manpower retraining bill. There we have federal funds available to move workers and their families to other areas of the United States if they so desire, and to retrain them in those areas for job vacancies in those areas. So there again, I point out that the emotional business of
The relocation of people immediately after slavery is unfounded. I don't believe now in the relocation of Negroes as proposed by some of the Southern senators, because that's just a gimmick.
That's clearly a gimmick.
That's clearly a gimmick.
The Brattleboro papers are gassed because they said they wouldn't be happy in Vermont, though.
Yes,
that one out, you know.
Well, I can recall when I married Hazel Scott, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Vermont, rented me his lakeside chalet for my honeymoon, and the neighbors of the Chief Justice threatened that if I did come for my honeymoon, that they would have my water supply cut off.
This is not so many years ago either.
Yeah, my son is 17 at MIT, so it'd be about 17 and a half, 18 years ago.
Well, it hasn't changed entirely, I can assure you.
Oh, I don't think anything will ever change entirely.
In Vermont. The theory that equality, in legal terms and all basic social arrangements, does not mean intermarriage necessarily.
Absolutely
not. It means the possibility
not.
Of it. It does not mean integration automatically. But it means probably, at least for a long time, an increasing of the centric forces that draw groups together.
Mm-hmm.
Does this theory works for you?
Oh, yes. The problem with the marriage is ridiculous because that's something you can't stop. White girl is to marry a Negro boy, or a Negro girl is to marry a white boy, you just can't stop it. And it's not widespread.
You certainly can't legislate it.
No, you can't legislate it. So it has nothing to do. I think Gunnar Myrdal pointed this out. This is the last thing Negroes wanted in his 10 points.
That was pointed out long ago by Mr. Frazier, too, and by others. What about quotas? We were touching on that a moment ago without actually getting at it. How do you feel about the whole problem?
I'm against quotas, but I'm in favor of preferential hiring as an emergency measure only until a norm is reached. And I base this not just on my feeling, but I base it on something that I did. In 40 or 41, I led the nonviolent picket campaign against the bus company of New York, because it wouldn't employ Negroes except as maintenance workers, cleaners. And in 12 days, I halted the buses in New York. And as a result, we had a tri-party agreement, legally drawn up, between Mike Quill of the transport workers, McCarthy, president of the bus company, and myself representing the Negro consumer. And in that, we agreed that the bus company would hire two Negroes for every white until a reasonable amount had been hired. From that moment, which is over 20 years ago, to this moment, I have had not one single complaint from a Negro
in the company or applying to the company. And today, Mike Quill has 10,000 Negro union members of the Transport Workers Union, and that is proof positive that preferential hiring does work and has worked, but purely as an emergency measure. The court is no.
Preferential hiring in at a certain level of competence.
Oh, yes. In other words, when two people appear and both equal, hire the Negro until you've got a reasonable number in your plant.
Reference to Quill reminded me of this notion. How does the Teamsters Union stand on the matter of race?
Locals that do not deal with cross-country hauling, very good. And the locals that deal with cross-country hauling, no good, because of the simple fact that a Negro Teamster pushing a truck across the country can't get accommodations.
Simple as that. It's not prejudice. It's a matter of...
Can't get accommodations.
It's outside the Teamsters Union attitude.
I have talked this over with Teamster officials, not with Mr. Hoffa. I've never spoken to Hoffa. I've only seen him in a restaurant in Washington at a distance once. But I've talked it over with other people, and this is their problem. That's why they're so much in favor of the Civil Rights Bill.
What do you think of Hoffa?
I don't know. I think the article by Fred Cook in last week's Nation is absolutely shocking. Nation devoted almost 50 pages to an analysis of the way they tried to and did hang Hoffa. It's unbelievable. The star witness, for instance, was on the payroll of the Department of Justice, which is against the laws of Congress, $150, $200 a week. Jurors not only was served liquor as they were locked in, but the male jurors were women were procured for them by the Department of Justice and paid for by the Department of Justice.
It gives jury duty a new glamour, doesn't it?
Well, if the women were glamorous, it did.
Yeah. What about Ruby? Do you make any sense of that?
No, I am completely at sea concerning that whole situation, Drummond.
It's a
to have a press conference. You know, he hasn't said one word to the press at all. Not one word has come out directly nor indirectly.
Well, I suppose we'll never know.
Yeah, I think that's it. We'll never know.
For sure.
That's right. All the king's men.
Well, that's one thing you'll never know. That one, old Huey. Here's a problem that's always up in one form or another. It's the intersection of the race question and the economic class question. How do you, I think I know your drift of thought on
yes,
this.
Sir.
How is that bell?
Adjournment.
Thank you. Go ahead.
This intersection, which is clear, it's in the fact, but not clear in the implications or the policy one should adopt toward it. I think I have some drift of your thinking about this, but could you be more specific and more theoretical, if you wish? We'll take the individual Negro. There's a race question and also an economic class question. Now, in dealing with this as a problem, how do you discuss this intersection or deal with this intersection of these two issues? Now, many Negroes now, and many white people now, think of the thing as purely a matter of race and think of integration as a panacea, a perfect medicine, you see.
I think the Negro participates in the economic class struggle in the United States the same as the white man. He indicates this himself by being one of the most consistent purchasers of brand commodities and of status symbols. I think that will continue as it is in every strata of American society. I think it's definitely
there, and integration wouldn't have anything to do with it because it's part of the American escalator system going up, the status symbols and the split-level housing and the Cadillacs and so forth.
There's one theory that conspicuous consumption is more obvious among Negroes because they have less outlet for their...
And because of the visibility, too.
And their visibility.
Yeah, see, a black man in a white Cadillac is different than seeing a white girl in a white Cadillac.
Yes, it's higher visibility.
Visibility. I take compact cars. Compact cars do not sell among Negro people as they're selling
among whites. People can't understand why I'm driving around in a 14-year-old Jaguar. Well, it serves my purpose. I'm not interested in status symbols, so then people say, well, that's because you don't need it.
Well, that is the truth. There's a truth about all status symbols, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, sure. A fellow standing on the office just now, an outstanding lawyer in New York, in Washington. He said, what are you doing this suit? And you got two holes in it. I said, I like it.
Have you, I know you heard, been reading the Young's Marshall Plan program?
Yes, that's the kind of thing that London has just applied to the Appalachian region, by the way. It's a really old WPA. I think my war and poverty bill will take out some of the wrinkles. I know my vocational education bill, my manpower retraining bill, my juvenile delinquency bill. These are the major...
They are more inclusive.
These are specifics. These are much more important than civil rights than to the Negro. Much more.
Because these are aimed at giving the context, creating a context.
That's right. Correct.
Let me ask you, what do you think of Abraham Lincoln?
Well, you're a historian, as I keep on saying, and I have read history. As you can see by my library here, this is one of my four libraries.
I'm certain of that.
I think Lincoln's vastly, vastly overrated.
I think that he did nothing at all. Except
that which he had to do, and he did it in terms of winning a war. He was concerned with the Union more than with slavery, and that's why I said that slavery was not the real issue involved in the war between the states.
What about Grant?
I don't know much about Grant at all, except Lincoln's famous remark about his drinking liquor.
Yes, yes.
And I never can understand, maybe you can tell me why. Why is Grant buried in New York City?
I don't know how he died up there at Mount McGregor and outside of New York. Except the fact he had lived there for some years there.
Yeah, but it wasn't his home.
No. He had lived up there in New York. Yeah. And his friends were there.
Yes?
Mr. Belushin at 5.
Hey, Nat.
When you go out on your way to the speaker's office, can you call me in the next 5 minutes? I'd like to ask you a question.
I won't be able to call you, Nat, for about... let's see, what time is it now? It's 2 o'clock?
5 after.
I'm going to be able to call you until when?
What did you say?
I'm going to be able to call you about 45 minutes.
Half an hour, minute?
Yeah, make it definitely 45 minutes. I'll telephone you.
Well, can you make it 20 or 3?
All right, at 20 to 3 exactly.
Because I have a quarter of 3 appointment at the Empire State.
All right, at 20 to 3, I'll call you.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
I'm going to make a dash in the 3 o'clock plane, which I have to get, so this is great. This is very generous of you, by the way, this time you're giving. Tell me this. I had a...
What do you think of Lincoln? What do you think of Grant?
Yes. Well, that wasn't... what's the role of the white man? The white liberal, that fellow that's being beat over the head by everybody now. What is his role?
All right.
In relation to the Negro Revolution and in relation to society in general.
All right. In relation to the Negro Revolution, Joe Barr, who writes a column for the... Barry, for the New York Post, asked me the same question in Paris last June at a press conference I held at the embassy there. My answer to him was very terse, not to be abrupt, but just to just give him the answer. Follow black leadership.
In the Negro movement.
That's right.
And
the white man no longer can nor should control black movements. This is the only ethnic group left in the United States that has participation by people from other groups. Interracial groups, I believe in.
But in terms of actual.
But in terms of the black revolution, no. Black led, white workers, white followers.
I know your remarks about Jack Greenberg.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the NAACP.
Jack Greenberg, Spingarn.
And Spingarn.
Right on down the board of directors.
That has been always a biracial organization.
So let it be known as one. Let it stop saying that this is the voice of the black masses. As long as you got so many whites sitting in the board of directors and president in policy-making positions. You can't find this in any other ethnic group. Polish American Congress, for instance. Polish American Congress wrote me the other day asked me if I'd make remarks on the floor of Congress and on the anniversary of Poland's being taken over by Russia. I, as a Negro, will make those remarks, but no Negro serves in the Polish American Congress. Federation Italian Society, Loyal Sons of St. Patrick, the Neighborhood, so forth and so on.
Well, it's time for the Negroes, 100 years of adolescence, to have their own black organization, with white liberals supporting in every way. Working on the staff, too.
Now, what is the white liberal's role in society outside of this question now?
To advance the entire cause of liberalism.
With
Negro liberals, I don't think there should be any such thing anymore as a white liberal. Just liberals. I think that's where we have taken the word liberal and decimated its thrust, its power, its value by saying white liberals and Negro liberals. No such thing.
Well, the phrase white liberal stems from the Negro side of the fence, usually.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
The Negro
is calling a white man a white liberal now when he wants to lead or be in the power structure of the black revolution. If he is a white man and he's a liberal in labor, housing, anything else, the Negro doesn't call him a white liberal.
Holiness.
Only when he wants to put his foot in the door of the policy making of the black revolution.
What about the whole liberal movement in America now? Aside from the question
of
the
I think it's it's almost finished, and it's just trying to come back. But beginning with McCarthy and during the Eisenhower period, this nation had a blanket of mediocrity. It became a cult. Like Samuel Hoffenstein once wrote years ago, come weal, come woe, my status is quo. That's a beauty. Now I think with the freshness of the Kennedy, of Jack and Jacqueline, there was a rebirth. And there's something in the air. And the white liberal and the Negro liberal are beginning to move again. But before, I think the liberal movement is just about finished.
Let me read you a quotation here from a man whose name you will know, Mr. Rose, Arnold Rose, Myrdal's collaborator, you remember, on Negro history, the rewriting of Negro history and the new investigations in it. The whole tendency of the Negro history movement, not as history, but as propaganda, is to encourage the average Negro to escape realities, the actual achievements, and the actual failures of the present. Although the movement consciously tends to build race pride, it may also cause Negroes unconsciously to recognize that their group pride may be built partly on this delusion, and this may result in devaluation of themselves or being forced to resort to self-deception. That's a long piece.
Yes. I know what he's trying to say. He's trying to say that the efforts of people such as the Association of the Study of Negro Life and History and people who are in the pulpit, meaning the broad pulpit, not just the church, to instill pride in Negroes might lead them to thinking that they are more than what they really are.
Because the evidence they offer has been not adequate for the claims made for it.
But on the other hand, persons such as myself, chairman of this committee on education with my staff and my tremendous resources, Library of Congress, we are initiating a curriculum study
of American textbooks, with a view of seeing that these textbooks more accurately portray the Negro, not with the view of building up some false pride in the Negro mass, but with a view of building up truth in the minds of Americans, white and black, concerning Negroes. For instance, very few people know that the first man to die that America might be free was Crispus Attucks, a black man from Barbados. The little monument tucked away in the commons up in Boston, that's all. If he had been white, there'd be a monument in nearly every major city. There'd be a poem about him, like a poem about Paul Revere and so forth. So we want to get this. We want to put the facts into textbooks for the good of white America, as well as for the good of Negroes.
Every country has its own myths, which is not substantiated by the facts.
Mm-hmm. Incidentally, that's a great line from Fulbright's foreign policy speech, that we are in conflict between the old myths and the new realities, and we are shrinking the grounds of discussion by confining discussion of this to what he called unthinkable thoughts.
Yes.
This is true.
Yes.
It's a great statement.
Yes.
And that's the problem
that's
we're facing. Not only foreign policy, everywhere. Old myths, the new realities, the unthinkable thoughts.
That's well put.
Oh, wonderful.
It's well put indeed. He has a gift for phrase.
Yes,
he is. He signed the Southern Round Robin.
Oh, sure.
Back in 50.
They're captives. 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 But I know them. I know them all. I have very, very good relationships. I gave the War and Poverty Bill to Landrum of Georgia. Very good relationships with men from the South. I know them. People would be amazed on both sides of the fences if they knew how well we got along. Because I know their captains. They got to get reelected. Right now, I have two or three outstanding Southern congressmen from the deep, hardcore South who are begging me to attack them in public because they're afraid they might lose the primary.
And you do this as a friend?
It's Carl Elliott of Alabama just today. Sure. Scared to death because of Wallace.
There's a line taken by James Baldwin and some other the Negroes of prominence that the real aim, one aim anyway, and you could say the ultimate aim, of the Negro Revolution is a moral regeneration of America.
Correct. That's my view. My view changed at the Bandung Conference. Until the Bandung Conference, I believed that everything that I had done in picketing in New York for 11 years, in being the first Negro in the New York City Council, in authoring or co-authoring every single civil rights bill in the Congress, I wrote the first FEPC.
20 years ago, it was my FEPC bill. I authored the Powell Amendment on the withholding of funds, which is in the FEPC bill. All of this was for the good of Negroes.
But when I came back from the Bandung Conference, April 19th, 1955, I said, no, this now is a fight to save America. The question of civil rights, the question of all these demonstrations, is not to help the Negro. This is to save the United States. Moral regeneration, yes, moral regeneration before the eyes of the world. And this is a question that's asked me when I go to important international conferences. I will be the chairman of the congressional delegation to the ILO convention in Geneva. Again, this year I've been there now 3 years in a row. Not just Black Africa, but White Europe asked me, how can we take the United States seriously on its position as being the leader of the free world when they have the picture of this Negro woman down the street with two policemen on top of her? This is the moral region. Baldwin is correct. This is no longer the Negro's fight. And the sooner the white man realizes, if it's not too late, the better.
How widely is it realized, do you think?
It's not. Not. It's realized very, very definitely and desperately by people in top positions of power. But when you get down into the counties and the backwash of America and the rural areas, and even in the cities, it's not realized. Lyndon Johnson made Carl Rowan head of the United States Information Service. In his own words, he said, I want a black man to be disseminating our propaganda. He has just
taken another Negro, friend of mine, Carter, who is Assistant Secretary of State, and known for this coming Friday, tomorrow, he will be made the Deputy Chief of Protocol of the United States. Why? Because the people who are coming here now are dark. Coming from Asia, Africa, Latin America, islands of the seas.
Now, how much is this old story, the Negro leader, in quotes, you see, in politics, in the arts, in business, anything else, as soon as he's dealing with the white world, he loses something with the Negro world, this old suspicion of the sellout, the implied sellout. Does that still subsist?
Yes, very definitely, very definitely. And unfortunately, it's proven repeatedly. When we had the demonstrations in New York City on the Glamison, I was the only elected Negro official that supported it. And the Negro press, the Amsterdam News, just
castigated editorially week after week. The assemblymen, city councilmen, state senators, so forth. Another problem is that Negro leaders don't live with Negroes. I am the only Negro leader, and I don't call myself a Negro leader because I don't have a national organization.
When I'm a congressman, I'm a minister of a church in the heart of Harlem. I am the only one that lives in Harlem. The others don't. They live Riverside Drive, Long Island, Westchester. It's all right for them to do it.
But if I can do it, why can't they?
Here in Washington, I live in the heart of the slums of Washington, in the southeast Washington.
Now
black slums.
Now we're up against the problem of integration.
Mm-hmm.
It comes out
mm-hmm.
of this.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a process, slow but increasing. In
sound like Henry
pace.
James, the definition of conversion.
Yes.
Remember his definition? Conversion is a process slow or sudden.
There's two things.
Sorry, William James.
Oh, please,
William James.
Yes, yes,
variety
yes,
of religious
yes,
experience.
Yes, yes,
I'm sorry.
I translated it, I realize.
Mm-hmm.
This matter of the pulling out from the Negro community of the successful Negro has been the basis of a lot of what has occurred with integration.
Mm-hmm.
That new range of associations, the actual
change of address.
The Negro leadership has got to stay with the Negro masses as he fights to integrate the Negro masses. And for him to go out and be integrated is of no help to the masses. He is taking, he's draining the leadership resources out of the community that needs it. Needs those resources.
But his presence, in some sense, he may to balance that law, so perhaps do a very small thing to balance it, does give a new public image on the Negro.
Now, don't believe it. No. Ralph Bunche moves where he did. I lived, for instance, in Fleetwood, in Westchester. I moved there in a street where a few years before they had broken out the windows and burned crosses on the lawn. So I moved this very lovely house, and it didn't affect the
attitudes of the people in bed. They didn't break out any windows and burn any crosses. Maybe because of
fruit. And after several years, my immediate neighbors, meaning the house next door and the house across the street, only became friendly with us on a semi-social basis. Gives them an escape. They can say, well, Ralph Bunche lives with us, or Jackie Robinson. That doesn't mean anything. It's like saying I'm
a nice member of the NAACP. I gave $1,000.
No Negroes
are suspicious of this. Back to your original question.
Yes.
Negroes are very suspicious of this breakfast that was held in the height of the demonstrations last year, where a courier of the Taconic Foundation got whites to pledge $800,000 to the Big Six civil rights movement. And immediate Negroes suspicious of a sellout. And I think, to a certain extent, they were justified, because one of the most able organizations in terms of demonstrations is SNCC.
And SNCC was part of the Big Six, and they didn't give SNCC a penny. I sent SNCC a $100 check just a couple of days ago, and they wrote me back from Atlanta, Georgia, thank God, because all we had in our treasury when your check arrived was $9.17.
Really?
But they got $800,000 split among the big boys. And I don't care whether it's overt or not. Subconsciously, when you get that kind of money into an organization that's operating on a marginal basis, you're going to think twice before you make some utterances or do some things.
You never know, Mr. Just take an episode like this. I live in suburbia, Connecticut. A group of people there.
I've been there. A friend of mine, a doctor, had a house. Riverside is near you, isn't it?
No, I live over in
Fairfield. Yes. You're in, sir. You're not on the coast.
I'm 6 miles inland.
Well, then, you're near Bridgeport or Connecticut, New Haven?
I'm on the side between Bridgeport and New York.
I see. Well, the Riverside is between Bridgeport and New Haven.
That's right.
Around the coast.
That's right.
Well, I have a very eminent and extremely wealthy doctor who has lived there for years. His weekend and summer house, very luxurious. No impression on his neighbors. Speaks fluent French. As Rolls Royce. No impression. Go ahead.
The question is simply this. People I know around that neighborhood are organizing. People I know, these are white middle-aged ladies
mm-hmm.
who take the civil rights movement and the integration question very seriously.
Mm-hmm. That's the group that does.
And they are giving a biracial dance
mm-hmm.
to raise money for the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of thing, I would have thought that certain Negroes I know would have been opposed to it.
1234, 1234, 1234, 1234. Five, six, seven, eight, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, 13.